Hello there and welcome to your Culture File Weekly with your presenter Luke Clancy. And in the bag this week, Joseph Young is bringing back the ancestors with his spectre-infused sound walk in the gardens of Kilruddery House. Neil O'Connor brings us for a walk among the bleeps and bips of a new experimental electronic music studio in Limerick. And Ruth Clinton goes some way to reckoning the responsibilities of the folk singer. But we begin this time with a spring watch of a sort in the late of Jennifer Walsh's Things No Things.
We recently acquired a very fancy alarm clock. This alarm clock is designed to wake you gradually, naturally. About half an hour before the time you've set to be woken at, the clock begins slowly lighting up, going from dark to dim orange to bright white over 20 minutes or so. About 5 minutes before the alarm sounds, birdsong gradually fades up. It's a gentler way to wake up than a standard alarm clock, and I enjoy it, though the fact that outside my window there's a real, actual dawn with real, actual birds singing for free is not lost on me. Sure, depending on when I have to get up, that real dawn may be either hours away or happening simultaneously or have just passed. But to have the sense of dawn, both the light and the birdsong which accompanies it, becomes something I can summon reliably at a time which suits me, feels both wonderful and sort of uncanny. This same strange feeling of versions of nature being abstracted and personalised follows me out of my bedroom and onto the internet. Spring is here, a local, personalised spring which is somehow both asynchronous and also continually in effect. The cherry blossom might be out in London, or about to come out in New York, or weeks past blossoming in Pakistan, but at this time of year, there will always be photos of sakura in hyper-saturated pink. Users post photographs of wisteria from last year, from 2 or 3 years ago, with predictions that the same flowers and trees will be in blossom very soon, in a week's time, in 10 days' time. Watch out for the pics. The aesthetics of how spring is captured and presented are the only unifying force. Whether the magnolia tree is in Connecticut or New Zealand, the video clips capture it in a slow pan. Daffodils are usually displayed in oversized ceramic pots. Peonies are more often than not held up in a huge bunch large enough to cover the face. Bunches of tulips are wrapped in paper and placed on a table next to a matcha latte or a lavender latte or a turmeric latte. And all over the world, thousands of young women pose alone on picnic blankets in flower-filled meadows, an expensive handbag and a bubble tea at their side. Hashtag spring vibes. The French philosopher Jean-François Lyotard writes in The Postmodern Condition that data banks are the encyclopedia of tomorrow. They transcend the capacity of each of their users. They are nature for postmodern man. All of the photographs, all of this data, from the filters used on a shot of someone posing in front of a lilac tree through to the time my alarm clock goes off each day, this is nature now. We're watching as the latest spring dataset blossoms, ready to be scraped and used for training the next generation of AI. But I have my own spring plans when it comes to AI. I've downloaded Cornell University's Merlin app. It's designed to identify birds by their song. So I'm off to invoke an asynchronous dawn on my alarm clock and figure out exactly which birds sing me awake each morning.
the latest in Jennifer Walsh's series Things No Things. And don't forget to check out the myriad of other episodes from Jennifer Walsh that are available on the Culturefile podcast feed. You can do that via the Lyric site or via your favourite podcast app. And next on the Culturefile Weekly, residual hauntings in County Wicklow. The Ancestors is sound artist Joseph Young's sound walk through the grounds of Kilruddery House in County Wicklow. In the music, story and field recordings work, the artist tries to make the visible and no longer with us leap from the Kilruddery archives into visitors' ears. Vanessa Noonan went to Kilruddery to meet the artist, walk the walk and talk the talk of ghosts, landscapes and the stone tape theory.
Do you want to just have a little wander around, just kind of get a little flavour of the place?
Yeah,
first,
that would be amazing.
And then we'll find somebody to sit. So my process as an artist working with sound essentially is to go somewhere and I listen. And I understand the world through listening. And out of that listening process, so often that takes place initially without any technology at all. And then I will perhaps, you know, go back to that place many times and find ways to record it and start to understand what are the kind of things there that are in the soundscape of that place now that tells me something about this place that I can then make a piece of work about it. And the way that work evolves, sometimes it might be an installation for a gallery space, it might be a film, it might be a text piece for a publication, it might be a digital album even, you know, all these kind of things, but it's it all starts with a process of essentially walking and listening, and that's how I understand the world. And so my job as an artist is to then take that walking and listening process and find a way of making that interesting for an audience. I was investigating the written archives of Kilruddery House and Gardens, where we're walking right now. So my job as an artist essentially was to look at their written archives and then to find a way of making an artistic experience or an encounter out of the archives. The big part of it, first of all, was to figure out, well, what's there? You know, you've got 400 years worth of written material, and then you've got to try and think, well, okay, you know, so you've got land deeds, you've got letters, you've got latterly, you know, photographs, you've got diary entries. And then it's finding a way to make that into what is now a geolocated sound walk in the estate called the Ancestors. So as you wander around the gardens, the formal gardens, you encounter these
until further notice
spectral characters from the archive.
The Kilruddery pleasure grounds are open to the public on foot on Mondays or possibly Thursdays.
So I've used something called binaural recording technology, which is essentially little tiny microphones you put inside your ears. And when you record in that way and you listen back, especially on headphones, you really get this sense of being there. You're right in the place. So it's like almost kind of virtual reality for audio. By doing that, and I work with some local actors to recreate some of the material from the archives, and then there are also musical episodes and there are contemporary field recordings. You hear the voices of the people that live here now, the family, the Brabazon family. And as you walk around, your phone senses where you are and things are triggered automatically as you walk around.
I go tomorrow to Glenmalure to see with my own eyes.
Should we keep walking? Let's go down here.
What each tenant
that's down by the long ponds
is doing.
Stone tape theory sounds fancy, but it's not really a theory at all. It's something that grew up on, as far as we know, on kind of paranormal sort of forums on the internet. But it relates back to sort of two particular sort of founding things. One is a BBC drama, horror drama, and that was about a group of technologists in a sort of an old English country house, and they inadvertently came across this idea that through technology you could kind of activate the ghosts.
Testing room wavelength, take one.
Stop it! Oh, stop it!
Hey, that's enough.
It's not there.
And that links back also to There was a writer called T.C. Lethbridge, and he was a former academic who got very interested in the paranormal and started writing a whole series of books. And although he never used the word stone tape theory, basically his ideas were the kind of basis for it. And he was particularly talking about trauma, so that historic events or traumatic events can be recorded by stones, like a sort of an analog tape recorder in a way, and that through technological intervention or through the minds of a sensitive person, somebody who's sensitive to these kind of energies, they can be replayed in the mind of the listener. And so that's the way I started to think about this sound walk, was that the technology is kind of a bit like a divining tool in a way, and that you're kind of wandering around kind of looking for sort of sonic ghosts in the landscape. But in this case, the listener doesn't have to do anything as such. You know, you can literally just kind of walk around and you'll encounter things. I wanted to do it like that rather than people sort of staring at their phones or having somebody describe what is there and what the archives are about. It's much more a sense of like an adventure or an encounter. You come across something, and as you start to hear these different stories from all these different times over the 400-year period, that you get to make up your own ideas about what these archives are about and how they relate to a bigger story of the sort of social history of the island of Ireland.
Underneath this stone do lie bones of men of days gone by, those who in Christ's faith have died.
One of the things that's in the sound trail is this figure called the Keeper of the Archive. And the Keeper of the Archive is essentially my voice. I wanted to be able to comment as an artist on the archive. So rather than have a central kind of audio guide voice that you get in a lot of museum audio tours that's kind of telling you about things, that kind of authoritative, authorial voice, I wanted to kind of, you know, mix things up a bit in a way to complexify the idea of the archives. So rather than say the archives is about this, it's about many things. What I learned from working with the family and talking about the way they already tell their heritage narrative, because this place is open to the public, but there's an existing heritage narrative, and I started with that, and you start to realize, well, that's the story. In the end, what you're doing here when you're making a piece of work about these historic archives is you're creating not exactly a fiction, but it is definitely storytelling told from a particular point of view. And what I wanted the ancestors to do was to open that up, so as the audience walks around, they have the opportunity to make up their own mind about what these archives represent. Again, coming back to stone tape theory, in a sense, what I've done here is to write the story onto the landscape digitally. So that you can go and uncover all those different layers of meaning as you wander the grounds.
Sound artist Joseph Young was talking there to Vanessa Noonan at Kilruddery House in County Wicklow, and visitors to the house and gardens can experience the work, the ancestors, via smartphone and the Echoes app, which you'll find at your app store, obviously. Would you believe that someone who loves electronic music would rather computers weren't involved in its making? Professor Neil O'Connor, otherwise known in these parts as electronic artist Ordnance Survey, is getting closer to having his wishes granted in a brand new facility at the University of Limerick, with bristling walls packed with logos from Raleigh, Schlappy Engineering, Dopefar, and other colleagues in the world of electronics equipment. The University of Limerick Electronic Music Studio, ULEMS, is on a mission to foster an experimental approach to electronic music making, as Neil O'Connor explained to Culture Files' Louise McMahon on a visit to the Electronic Music Studio.
No. So, I guess, where are we?
We're in the Department of Computer Science and Information Systems at the University of Limerick, and we're in the Electronic Music Studios. I'm Neil O'Connor. I'm an associate professor in all these machines, I suppose, sound recording, electronic music and so on. So we have everything in here routed to the mixing console, which is played back here in stereo. So we have all our MIDI devices here on this side. These are then some analog synthesizers that can be played and performed in real time. We have obviously some MIDI ones here in red. Bukele 200E
H90.
Poly 800
CS5 and the Seal XP8.
This is a Dofer A100.
So over to our left here, we have a Bukele 200E. This is a very, very special machine. It's the price of a very nice car. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to set up the Bukele. It's on four channels. I'm also running it into an effects processor over here, this H90.
Okay.
Which will give us... this type of sound.
It sounds really awe-inspired. It sounds like awe.
It's analog and digital. There's program banks that you can store. It's MIDI compatible. So it's not fully an analog machine, but what you'll see in the circuitry and certainly in things like the oscillators and so on will have analog processing.
So it kind of looks like an opened out suitcase, lots of patch cables and gain control.
And now I can do a little bit of filtering, but generally it's a modular synthesizer, so it's generating different sounds and filtering them in different ways. And we have it set up in what's known as quadraphonic. And now that it's in quadraphonic, I'll just show you the difference between regular.
So there's two speakers here at the front,
four channels,
and two speakers here behind.
And what's known as a spatial quadraphonic. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4 labeled on either side. So what I can do now is I can do this really, really interesting thing, that swirl, which means it will travel between the four speakers. So if I turn one on, you'll see what that's A, B, C, and D.
They're Genelec speakers.
Yeah, and now they're moving around. So if you stand in the middle, you'll get a kind of swirling effect between the four.
All right, can I go do that?
Don Bukele was a synthesist and a synthesized maker based in Berkeley or Oakland in California in the 1960s, and he had a very different approach from what's known as East Coast synthesis, which have been people like Robert Moog, who built the Moog synthesizer. This is West Coast, which sounds very esoteric and very different to the East Coast, which is a little more tame, uses different types of filtering and so on. As you can see here, this is far more complex. Last year I went to a studio in Holland, William Twee Studios, and it's based on a 1950s electronic music studio where there's no real musical equipment. It's more based on test equipment from electronics. So we tried to recreate a much smaller version of this over here. These things here, like function generators and hardware oscillators, are more used in engineering. But we're turning them into musical instruments. So you would use oscillators that would generate a sound, and then you would use many, many oscillators together to generate much more complex devices. It's a residency studio. I'd say we're 90% complete of the studios. There's still a little bit that needs to happen, and I think a recording mechanism where either students or researchers can come in and record directly to magnetic tape and bypass the computer is something that I would really like to do. If I had my way, I probably wouldn't have a computer. I'd go back to just, because then I work in another studio and we have tape machines and I do a lot of tape recording. So I love to get away from the computer completely and not have anything to do with digital. Because in the studio in Holland, they had the same. So when I was recording on the instruments from the 1950s, I was recording directly to tape.
And it's a warmer sound, would you say? Is that what you're chasing? Like, why is that your preference?
Obviously it sounds different. The way that the frequencies are hitting the tape will generate a certain harmonic detail. I think the added bonus of tape music is that you're not doing any micro editing. You can't go back and change things. You can, but it's very cumbersome when you start to cut up the tape. And I've done that before. It's, you know, you make an edit, it's going to take you 10 minutes. You do an edit on a computer, it'll take you 10 milliseconds. So the students can have, if they want to make, you know, drum and bass or hip-hop or whatever they wanted. All those machines are here. But for them, for those students who want to go into a more experimental mode, we've got the most cutting-edge facilities in not only in Ireland, but in some educational facilities in Europe. So that's why it's really important to magnify that fact that this is a really, really, really unique place, not only in Ireland, but in educational places in Europe.
Neil O'Connor there, bending circuits with Louise McMahon at the brand new University of Limerick Electronic Music Studio. Once this weekend's New Music Dublin extravaganza is in the rearview mirror, the Tradition Now Festival takes over at the National Concert Hall in Dublin the following weekend. As the title suggests, Tradition Now aims to gather musicians whose work has been tuning the tradition for operation in the world of 2024. Among those doing just that is artist and singer Ruth Clinton, familiar to regular listeners for her work with the all-woman vocal ensemble Landless. She's brought together a group featuring Cormac of Lancome, Consuela of Vero, and Landless's Sinead Lynch to sing songs from her book The Fearless Maid 2. Their music finds in songs old and new ways to protest in quiet and sometimes less quiet terms about misogyny, racism and violence. Culture Files Angela O'Shaughnessy visited Clinton and the group at rehearsals in Galway to hear about the powers of song and the responsibilities of its singers.
Hi.
Hello, how are you? Come in.
It's so great to meet you.
Very
blowing the heat out like it should.
Yeah, let me see. Which ones? What are we doing? So we're going to do one called The Banks of Scilly, which is a kind of unusual version of a ballad which would be known as like The Shepherd Lad or The Baffled Knight. I think Nina Simone sang it as The Young Knight, maybe. So there's tons of versions of it. And the general gist of the narrative is that there's a woman alone in the woods or in bathing in a pond or whatever, and a man comes along and is like, will you ride with me, and whatever implications are there. And then she basically tricks him into accompanying her home to her dad's house, and then she goes in and locks herself in and then slags him from inside, from safety. I suppose it's supposed to be kind of lighthearted, but it is, I don't find it particularly funny. I think it's impressive how she kind of turns the situation around and uses him basically as an escort to get home, and then teases him. But I love this version. It's Alan Lomax recorded it from a man called Captain Pearl or Nye, I think his name is, who was from Ohio, a boatman. And this particular version has a verse where after the man does the usual like, oh, all women are deceivers, you can't trust them, which is such a trope in folk songs, she then like takes out a penknife and stabs the ground because she's just so fed up, and just tells him that he's like a useless little white rooster. So yeah, it's really good.
You're like the little white rooster that runs among the hens. He flaps his wings but dare not crow, you're just like one of them. And it's you and I together, love, how happy we may be, but we'll not sport together on the vines of Scilly.
We all kind of go way back, so we're not starting from zero, I suppose. Me and Cormac played together as Poor Creature, and then Consuelo has often filled in Landless, so we're really kind of used to each other now at this stage. One of the reasons we came here is because we knew there was some people playing old time, and we played old time. And then we started our own session in McGlynn's pub, and now we all play there every week. So obviously in trad, in Irish trad, you move on to the next tune, but old time you just play the same one for however long you feel like playing it. And it's become very trancey and meditative. It's also, I think we've got a nice kind of democratic, it's very egalitarian, let's just say. This Fearless Maid book, a lot of those, I think they were kind of maybe historically interesting, but most of them I wouldn't have ever ended up singing. So I really made an effort with this one to pick songs that I think people will want to sing. I've also included the sheet music, written out the notation, so hopefully it'll be kind of more functional as a songbook. I'm really excited to actually perform them. I suppose I would have been really influenced in my singing by probably primarily singers from the northern half of the country who sing in English. So people like Rita Gallagher and Rosie Stewart. And then people who'd be more closer to my age, like Helen Diamond, for example, would have totally influenced the way I sing. And obviously there is a connection with Shanos in that the style is ornamented, but at the same time it is distinct from it, and there would be an English language song tradition as well. And then I suppose over the years, gradually adding instruments as you go. If we're choosing songs now to learn and perform, it is important to question the power dynamics that are in those songs so that you're not perpetuating the same things over and over. To take a very specific example, I don't think I sing any murder ballads. That's not to say I wouldn't listen to them or anything, or I wouldn't stop anyone else from singing them, but for me it doesn't really sit right, these female characters being killed over and over and over in songs for hundreds of years. There's just something unsettling about that. And then there's ones with more subtle power dynamics where the woman is just kind of passive or just like a mute beauty, or where she's just a symbol for Ireland, basically, isn't even a human, really. And so also, one thing I kind of should say is that I'm aware that this is like very binary as well. Some of the songs I think I found are a little more fluid, some of the older ones, but it's reflective of the material, I suppose. At the same time, I would sing plenty of songs that are just pure romantic and probably don't have brilliant power dynamics in them. So in no way am I trying to like cancel out any songs at all. It's more just adding to the field, digging up a few old ones and looking for some more recently written ones. Culture in general, not just music, all the culture that we consume very much shapes our reality and what we accept as normal. Whether that's like state institutions like the mother and baby homes, direct provision, or larger world power balances, to take the most pertinent and harrowing example, like the genocide in Palestine. We were also very kindly given permission to include Angeline Morrison's song, Unknown African Boy Died 1830. She just couldn't find any decent ones that mention black people, even though there's obviously been black people on the British Isles since Roman times. So she wrote some to kind of fill that gap. She was hoping that they would kind of become part of the tradition then, and people would actually sing them. And this is a particularly beautiful and absolutely tragic one about a ship that was wrecked off the Isles of Scilly, and the ship contained all these very like luxury items, but also the body of an unknown West African boy who was probably around 8. So she sings the song from the mother's perspective, and it's kind of a lullaby. It's very difficult lyrics to hear and to sing, but it's really beautiful. So very glad to be able to include that.
Ruth Clinton and friends there, and they'll be performing at the NCH Dublin on Friday, May 3rd, on a bill which also includes passing on the songs, Thomas McCarthy's celebration of travellers' culture, as well as music from Sheffield's Jim Geddy. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more harmonic ethics next Saturday tea time. Till then, bye now.